We have a very special opportunity tonight to learn about someone that you probably don't know their name, but you certainly know what they created, or you know of what they created. His name was Rav Nathan Sternhart. Does anyone know who is Rav Nathan Sternhart? Anyone? No one's heard the name, right?
Nope.
You saw what I wrote in the thing, so you're guessing it has something to do with Breslov. As we will see, Rav Nathan Sternhart was the main student of Rav Nachman of Breslov. And to even use that phrase, while it sounds pretty fundamental, it sounds pretty significant, he was the main student, that's actually an understatement. I would say, based on what we'll learn tonight, you will understand and appreciate that Rav Nathan Sternhart is not just the student of Rav Nachman of Breslov, but he was the reason, the only reason why anyone knows anything about Rav Nachman of Breslov. He is the only reason why there is a movement known as Breslov or Hasidus. But let me explain by going back to the beginning. Rav Nathan Sternhart, was born in 1780 in Nemirov. Nemirov is a small but formidable city in Ukraine. And he was born to what I would call a regular, traditional Talmudic family. I'm not sure what is going on with the camera over here, but the reason that I say regular is because, I would call them, they're run-of-the-mill, family at the time. But if you think about the number 1780, right, so we know about the beginning of Hasidus, and the year 1780 is really at the pivot point where Hasidus is taking off. The Maggid of Mezrich, in much the same way of Rav Nathan to Rav Nachman, where the Maggid of Mezrich, Rav Dov Ber, Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich was the main student of the Baal Shem Tov and is really the one who's responsible for making most of Hasidic sects exist. That's what the Maggid did. So the Maggid, who again is responsible for many of the Hasidic sects that come from the Baal Shem, so he died in 1773, somewhere around then. And that just gives you a general sense of where we are in the history of Hasidus, right? Before we get into what Rav Nathan's contributions were. So if I were to say what kind of family, if I were to ask someone in 1780 what kind of family did Rav Nathan what was he born into, they wouldn't say normal, they would say misnagdish, right? He was certainly born into a misnagdish family, people who didn't care for Hasidus at best, and at worst were oppositional to Hasidus, as we shall see. He grew up and his family was actually pretty wealthy. So wealthy that he got to marry a Rav's daughter. You know, back then, unfortunately, the way that it worked was that people with money who could support a rabbinic lifestyle actually were the ones to get the shidduchim with the rabbis. So his parents were wealthy, even despite the fact that he was young at 13 years old. That in some ways bolsters the claim that they need the parents to be wealthy. He nonetheless is able to get a shidduch at 13 years old with the daughter of the Av Beis Din of a nearby town called Shanigrad. I think that's what I wrote here. Rav David Tzvi Orbach was the Av Beis Din, the head of the court system in this neighboring town. He was 13. I can imagine she was around the same age. Her name was Esther Shendel. And they had four kids together ultimately, Shachna, Yitzchak, David Tzvi, and Chana Tzurl. I believe they had other kids that died in infancy, unfortunately. But for the first couple of years of their marriage, so Rav Nathan and Esther Shendel lived with her parents in Sharigrad for 2 years. And these 2 years were while very supportive of him. Again, he's a teenager, literally. I'm not just calling him young. He's a literal teenager from the ages of 13 to 15. He's living with his in-laws and being supported by them, and presumably still learning. To the extent if he wanted to, he could probably go into the business. It might be the case that he actually did go into the business. But the reason why those 2 years are so important for the life of Nathan Sternhartz are really because those are the times that he's influenced by his in-laws. When I say that he was born into a Misnagdish family, that was nothing like his in-laws. His in-laws were really Misnagdish. They really fought against and were opposed to Hasidus. And this really kicked up in the, you know, in the aftermath of the Vilna Gaon. We've talked about this before. The Vilna Gaon writes his famous, I don't know what you call it, Kol Kore, his edict against Hasidus in April of 1772 that really starts the sort of the division between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. And Rav Nathan Sternhartz, his father-in-law, was a staunch opponent of Hasidus. He was in very much in line with, you know, with the Vilna Gaon's take. And for 2 years, while living in his household, Rav Nathan was very much influenced by that oppositional attitude. For whatever reason, they moved back to Nemirov to be by Rav Nathan's father. Now, Rav Nathan's father, or at least his personal biological family, was not as, you know, hostile to Hasidus, but the influence of his father-in-law still remained within him. So when his friend came over one winter when he was 15 years old, after moving back to his father's house, and said to him, "Hey, you know, I've been dabbling in this Hasidus thing. Maybe you should try it." Rav Nathan's instinct was, "No way, Jose. No way. Not going to happen." You know, he can hear his father-in-law's voice in his head telling him, "Nope, you can't do that. I'll disown you." And he starts to warm up to it. He starts to argue with his friends. And he tells them, the Hasidim don't really have true Yiras Shemayim, and all the Misnagdish claims and accusations against the Hasidim. And he actually writes, and I'm not sure if Rav Nathan Sternhartz writes an autobiography. So some of this is actually written in his autobiography. So it's not like a legend that the Hasidim made up later on. No, this is, he said it himself. He could feel the influence of his father-in-law during those discussions. Like he knew exactly why he was oppositional. He knew why he was disagreeing. But that's, that's his father-in-law. Had influence on him. After a while, however, he figured, okay, what's so bad? I'll dabble a little bit. You know how it gets started. Slippery slope. But the truth is, that Rav Nathan Sternhartz, while willing to engage a little bit with Hasidus, actually doesn't take to it. He tries it out, and it could be, there are different versions of this. There is a book that actually, if anybody's interested in getting a greater sense of it, I was not able, unfortunately, to listen to all of it, but on YouTube, for those who are familiar, you could actually listen to the entire audiobook of a biography of Rav Nathan Sternhartz. It's in like 16 different 10-minute segments, which is not so, if you put it on double speed, you get through it with an entire book in an hour. I believe the title of the book was something like Through the Fire or something like that. And it's a biography of Rav Nathan. So in there, I don't have this, when I researched, I didn't see this, but this book claims it, and I would give more credence to the book than my research, for sure. The book claims that Rav Nathan actually struggled a little bit. He struggled with concepts of futility, right? That everything that we do is purposeless, that everything is, there's no point in doing anything. There are other names for this, I believe. Isn't nihilism, isn't that another word for that? Futility, right?
Nihilism, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So he struggled with this. He really struggled. And I think in some ways this is what that book claims. Again, I didn't see this myself, but this is what that book claims, that this is part of why he was searching. And he wasn't just satisfied with going along in his typical upbringing. He was looking for answers. He was looking for inspiration. And nothing was holding. Nothing was stopping him. He even went to the great Rebbe Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. Rebbe Levi Yitzchak was at that time, perhaps after the Maggid, was really the sort of the leader, one of the major leaders of Hasidus, at least in that area. I believe Chabad was already off and running in their place, but that was way off. That was sort of in a different geographical area entirely. And then there's Karlin, which is also a little bit different. But the point is that he went to the top of the top. Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev was, you know, the most, you know, expert Hasidic leader, and it wasn't doing it for him. It just didn't click. Then, at least according to the book, there's this other friend that comes and says, hey, you know, there's this guy a town over. It wasn't in Breslov, it was in this other place, which was nearby, and his name was Rav Nachman. Okay, so he figures, I'll try it out. What do I have to lose? And as the story goes, as you can imagine, he meets Rav Nachman in the middle of Elul, right? So he's 22 years old. At this point, he's 22 years old. It's 1802. There are other important things happening in Litvak world in the beginning of the 1800s. We've talked about that before, with Chaim Volozhiner and the yeshiva and everything. But in 1802, he meets Rav Nachman in the middle of Elul, in the middle of September. And by Rosh Hashanah, he already had decided, this is where I'm meant to be. He decided that something about Rav Nachman's Torah that really hit him in his kishkas, and he figured, this is where I'm meant to be. And by Rosh Hashanah, he was not only a devout student of Rav Nachman, but so devout was he that he started writing down everything Rav Nachman said. Now, obviously, on Shabbos, you can't write things down. But he was gifted with a certain kind of memory that he was able, after Shabbos, after Yontif, to write everything down, sometimes even verbatim. And this process actually not only was his own personal project. Rav Nachman found out about it. Rav Nachman, the legend goes that Rav Nachman noticed that he was his Talmud from the second he stepped in, and he knew that he was going to be his major student, whatever. Rav Nachman sort of enlists him to not just write for himself, but to write for the group, that for the people of Breslov or Hasidus, they should have a documentation of everything that the Rebbe says. And by Hanukkah already, he was transcribing these lectures, not just for himself, but for the entire movement. So in a matter of a couple of months, right? How long ago was Rosh Hashanah? That's 3 months ago, right? He's already become the scribe of Breslov or Hasidus. Now, you and I think of Breslov or Hasidus, we think, oh, wow, that's a big job. He rose to prominence pretty quickly. It wasn't that big at the time, right? Rav Nachman was pretty young. Rav Nachman himself was only born in 1772. And I don't know if people know this, but Rav Nachman, I think, passed away before his 40th birthday. Rav Nachman of Breslov, right? Rav Nachman Breslover. Rebbe Nachman, that the thing about, I think he was only like 38 when he died, something like that, maybe even younger. Maybe 1808. I know there's an 8 in there somewhere. He might have been 36 when he died. So it's not like he had that much time to grow the movement. There wasn't much of a movement at all. Rav Nosson Sternhardt, who we're talking about tonight, the main student of Rav Nachman, is the one who really makes it into a movement. He is the one that originally starts writing down all of the sichos, writing down all of these lectures, and sooner or later, people start to read these things. And Rav Nachman became very particular. Rav Nachman, even though he was in his own way closely connected to the original roots of Hasidus, by that I mean not ideologically, but biologically, he was the great, not Ben Achar Ben, not son through son, but he was the great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, right? So the Baal Shem Tov, like, started Hasidus. He was his great-grandson, right? So he wasn't, you know, he wasn't lacking yichus. What he was lacking, however, was the ideological linear connection, right? He was the progeny of Hasidus, but he certainly wasn't the ideological progeny. He certainly thought about things in his own way. And in many ways, the other Hasidic masters took an oppositional, you know, view of Rav Nachman's teachings, because they were very different, and we'll talk about them soon. But because of this, because of the possibility of friction between other sects of Hasidus, so Rav Nachman Sternhartz makes it his job to keep the teachings of Rav Nachman isolated, keep them within what he would call Anshei Shlomenu, the people of our peace, right? The people that are with us, right? Only the Breslovers can see Rav Nachman's Torah. I don't know 100% what the concern was. Maybe they would get excommunicated and they would cause unnecessary hostility. But this was Rav Nachman's attitude. So much so that he bought his own printing press, Rav Nachman Sternhartz, in 18, I don't know what it was, sometime in the 1800s, you know, in that first decade of the 1800s, he buys a printing press, which you can imagine was not that, you know, cheap of an endeavor. He buys his own printing press that nobody else could use. It was exclusive for the Breslovers. And that's how, I think there are some stories how some of the teachings got out and people weren't happy about it, something like that. I don't remember. But the personal life of Rav Nachman, of Rabbi Nachman, right? So Rabbi Nachman, the student who's now transcribing and disseminating the Torahs of Rav Nachman, so his personal life wasn't getting off to the greatest of starts. We had mentioned before that his father-in-law was a misnagid and his family wasn't so supportive either. Both of them were like, what are you doing? You know, his father-in-law kicked him out of the house. Well, he had already left, but he said he can't come back to the house. And his own father said he couldn't stay in the house. Rabbi Nachman's wife, we mentioned before, her name was Esther Shandel, she stayed in his father's house, right? So she stayed in her father-in-law's house in Nemirov, but Rabbi Nachman didn't. Now, it happened to be that Rabbi Nachman was away with Rav Nachman. They didn't live in the same place, which is peculiar. And I believe Rav Nachman talks about the sacrifices that were necessary. Rabbi Nachman talks about the sacrifices that were necessary for him to be the student of Rav Nachman, even against the wishes of Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman told him to go home. And Rav Nachman says, no, I have to stay here. So people did not take to that kindly. His personal family and others also, you know, well, you're leaving your family to be Rav Nachman of Breslov. Like, who is this guy? So it came with a considerable sacrifice to be the student also. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I remember this from years ago, that Rav Nachman writes in his autobiography or in his letters to the other Breslovers, like, if you want to be part of this movement, you're going to have to sacrifice a lot, and it's not going to be easy, that kind of thing. So that's what he said, and that's, you know, kahava, that's what he did. So he's traveling with Rav Nachman. Ultimately, his wife also gets kicked out of his house. He says somehow he was able to support her on the side. At the age of 25, Rav Nachman, this is 1805, Rav Nachman started learning Kabbalah, and he started writing down his own ideas, always with the influence of Rav Nachman. Good. There are little things here and there. We'll talk about the Sfarim that he starts to develop through Rav Nachman's Torah as we go on in a little bit. But suffice to say, he started writing some of these things down. He started sort of the beginnings of some of his Torahs. And by 26, he had a son named Meir who died at the age of 3. And unfortunately, he wasn't able to go back for the funeral of his son. At least that's the story. His wife was not happy. As you can imagine, his wife was not happy about all of this. But she understood that this is what brought him, you know, satisfaction. If you remember, I said before, Rav Nachman was not having an easy time emotionally, spiritually, and this was really what reinvigorated him. So while she was, you know, not pleased, she nevertheless understood why he was doing it. In 1807, Rav Nachman contracted tuberculosis. This will ultimately be how his wife died, Rav Nachman's wife, and Rav Nachman himself died. But at the time, Rav Nachman contracted tuberculosis in 1807, and he died in 1810. So that's where my confusion came from. He died in 1810. He was 38 years old. 38 years old. Rav Nachman of Breslov was 38 years old when he died of tuberculosis after fighting it for 3 years. But before he died, Rav Nachman gathers the Talmidim. Does anyone know where did Rav Nachman of Breslov gather his Hasidim on his deathbed? Any guesses? You'll know it when I say it. He gathered them all in a place called Uman. Gathered in Uman in Ukraine. And on his deathbed, he stressed to the Hasidim three things. Number one, the Shulchan Aruch. Got to learn the Shulchan Aruch, which, interestingly enough, Rav Nachman then goes on to write a sefer about the Shulchan Aruch, which we'll talk about soon. And number two, he says the idea of hitbodidut, loneliness, or more aptly translated, probably solitary meditation. I'd say it like that, solitary meditation. And number three is you got to come to Uman on Rosh Hashanah. This is not a brand new thing. You see the pictures of it today. You see, you know, the busloads and the planes that are going there every Rosh Hashanah. This is a minhag from Breslov Hasidim for the last 200 years, 200 plus years, that the Hasidim of Breslov would go to Uman for Rosh Hashanah. That's where Rav Nachman was buried, even though it wasn't really where he lived, it was nonetheless where he was buried. Rav Nachman would travel around Ukraine after this 1810, and he would continue to write and inspire the Anshei Shlomenu, as I said before, the people that were followers of Rav Nachman. Interestingly enough, as opposed to all other Hasidic sects that we've talked about, sort of, as opposed to all other Hasidic sects that we've talked about, Rav Nachman never appointed a successor. Now, there's one, the reason why I hesitated before is because Chabad, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe of Nachum Mendel Schneerson, also did not appoint a successor. That, however, was a break from the norm, right? He was the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. So while Chabad doesn't have any continuation of the Hasidic master lines, right? There's no one continuing the leadership. Rav Nachman, from the outset, never appointed a leader. And Rav Nachman thought that it would not be appropriate to do so. It would splinter the group, perhaps. And instead, he was going to take it upon himself to continue spreading the ideas, furthering the mission of Rav Nachman, and instead of taking over for Rav Nachman. He was the de facto leader of Breslov, right? It's not like anybody didn't know, you know, who's running Breslov. It's Rav Nachman. Everyone knew it was Rav Nachman, but nonetheless, he always opposed, you know, anyone who called him the Rebbe. He was not the Rebbe. He was the student of the Rebbe, Rav Nachman of Breslov. You might think, oh, Rabbi, is this where the Nana Nachman thing comes? No, it's not. The Nana Nachman thing that's now become so popular and all these songs and the people dancing with the pace and everything, that only came 130 years later, 120 years later, in 1923, something like that, one of the big Breslover Rebbeim, not the Rebbe, but, you know, one of the Breslover scholars, gets a note that was left to him from heaven or something. It's somewhat of a legendary tale. And on it, it says, you know, Nana Nachman, Nachman Me'uman, something about Mashiach, and then they ran with it from there. So that concept is only about 80, 90 years old. Rav Nachman never said such a thing. Rav Nachman never, you know, promoted such a thing. I don't know enough to believe or not believe, but I've never seen any indication that in Rav Nachman's life or in Rav Nachman's life, there was some kind of, you know, understanding that Rebbe Nachman would be Mashiach. I don't think there's any such understanding until this Nana Nachman thing starts, you know, 115 years later, whatever, 110, 12 years later. So basically, the movement of Breslov was all dictated by Rav Nachman. When I say it was dictated by Rav Nachman, I don't just mean that after Rav Nachman died, Rav Nachman went around and continued his ideas. What I mean is, Rav Nachman of Breslov that we know about never wrote a thing in his life. He never wrote anything down. The only person that ever wrote down any ideas from Rav Nachman was Rav Nachman. He wrote every single thing down from Rav Nachman. That's the only reason we have any of the Torahs of Rav Nachman. And not only that, but many of the Svarim that Breslov or Hasidim learned today were not lectures of Rav Nachman. They were ideas of Rav Nachman that he intuited from Rav Nachman, right? So he was sort of inspired or you know, infused with certain ideologies, and Rav Nachman wrote them down in his own books. So while in the introduction to the book, it attributes the ideas to Rav Nachman never said many of them. And in fact, I believe there are, I don't want to say it off the top of my head. I believe there are four books that are Rav Nachman's lectures, and then there are like eight books that are Rav Nachman's books based on Rav Nachman, right? So most of Breslov or Hasidus is actually Rav Nachman. I can't tell you to what extent. Is it all mirroring? Is it all, you know, based on Rav Nachman? I'm not even close to, you know, knowledgeable enough to understand the nuances about who said what. But suffice it to say that a lot of the material is not only, all of the material is exclusively because of Rav Nachman, but a lot of it is actually written by Rav Nachman, not just transcribed by Rav Nachman. There were other, not only was there opposition from other sects of Hasidus, there was opposition from the Misnagdim also. There was one Rav, I actually don't know if he was a Misnagid or if he was another Hasidic Rebbe, but the Savrenner, I don't know how to pronounce it, but Rav Moshe Tzvi of Savran, so he actually, he publicized smear campaigns against Rav Nachman when he's 54 years old. This is much later already. But in, you know, the 1830s, he has the whole smear campaign and he reports him to the authorities. He ultimately says that Rav Nachman was threatening, you know, the powers that be. I don't remember who exactly it was. And he gets imprisoned. He goes to prison. Then Rav Nachman escapes prison because he had, you know, connections in the people, the commoners in that city. Either way, the Savrana Rebbe dies, you know, 4 years later, and basically all opposition at that point to Breslov had died out. So Breslov was there to stay, despite the fact that Rav Nachman was, you know, up in age. It had now become a bona fide movement unto itself. And by the way, in the meantime, Rav Nachman's wife died. He gets remarried in the meantime. He has another couple of kids, one of them named Nachman, presumably after Rav Nachman. Suffice it to say that the movement had already taken root. The literature had already been written, especially that from Rav Nachman himself. And then Rav Nachman was still writing his stuff. But there are a lot of different books. I can't even pretend like I know what all of them are. I know for sure that Likutei Halachos is a commentary on, an exposition of something. It's like elaborating the halachos of the Shulchan Aruch, right? It's regular halacha. It also includes some things in the Parsha. There's Likutei Moharan, which is his ideas or Rav Nachman's ideas about sort of character building. There's Sefer Hamidos, also about character. Likutei Moharan is more like his lectures. Sefer Hamidos is more of the character building concepts that the Rav Nachman talked about. There's Sipuri Ma'asios. Maybe you're familiar with Rav Nachman's stories. So that's another one of the books that Rav Nachman wrote. There's Tikkun HaKlali, which is a special, you know, order of saying Tehillim, which he wrote down for specific purposes. Then there's what am I missing? Then there's I think it's called Tfilos Moharan, which are special prayers that Rav Nachman wrote in line with the concepts of Rav Nachman, right? So he came up with all the words himself. It's actually it's a fascinating concept that I haven't seen very often. It's a book of different things that you can say for different purposes. They're his own words, but they're very accessible words. I don't know if anyone has them. I actually brought one with me and I left it in my office, but The words, each piece is very lengthy, but you know, it's dozens of different davenings, things you can just talk to Hashem about. And as I mentioned before, Rav Nachman is very big on the concept of hispodidus, of going out by yourself and just talking to Hashem. Obviously, you have to daven shachar, you have to daven mincha and maariv, but find some time. Yeah, I think I saw somewhere that he recommends an hour a day, just going out by yourself and talking to Hashem in your own words. And if you need help, so Rav Nachman has this siddur. If you need help with this thing or that thing, so read these words. And they're very accessible. It's not like the type of thing where, like, I don't know what this word means. What's a dvir? You know, what's the, you know, what does it mean? Samach David. Like, there aren't any cryptic or poetic words. I mean, it's somewhat poetic, but the words are very accessible. So anyone with a basic understanding of Hebrew could most likely understand those prayers. I have some if anyone wants to look at them, but I think you can probably get them online also. I think there's also Likute. There are different books that are many of them are called Likute something because they're collections of what Rabbi Nachman said. That's what the word Likute means, a collection, a compilation maybe. And just to point out some of the salient messages of Breslover Hasidus. All were publicized by Rav Nachman, but they were all infused with the ideology of Rav Nachman. A couple of major, major themes that come up in Rav Nachman's teachings. So first of all, he was very big into telling stories. That's why he has a bunch of Rav Nachman stories. People are familiar with the story about the treasure under the oven. Anyone know that one? No, you don't know the treasure? All right, I'll tell a story time. This is a story, by the way, Michael knows. I'm sure Michael knows it. Yeah?
I want to hear it again.
Okay. Story goes that a chassid was, and this, by the way, this story, I believe, is told over in different versions. One of them is Rav Nachman's version. So I don't know if it's an exclusive Rav Nachman story, but it's a famous one. The chassid is looking. He doesn't have parnasa. He needs some help, et cetera, et cetera. So he goes to the Rebbe. The Rebbe says, go to so-and-so. Go to so-and-so, such as such a place. Oh, no, he had a dream. That's what it was. It's not a Rebbe. He had a dream. The dream said to go to such and such a place, go to this specific bridge, and under that bridge, there's buried treasure, and then you can take that for your parnasa. Okay, good. So the guy takes up the trek, and obviously I don't remember all the details, but he gets to this place, and he's excited to start his excavation. But lo and behold, the bridge has a guard there. Okay, there's a guard, so okay, so fine. I can't dig right now, but I'll just wait for the guard to go away. He can't possibly stand there all the time. So he waits. So he waits and he waits and he waits. And he's, you know, minding his own business. And the guard, every once in a while, comes over and says, you know, what are you doing here? And he says, oh, I'm just hanging out, whatever. And sure enough, a few days pass, and there's never not a guard there. There's always someone watching the bridge. So after a while, the guard says, no, you got to get out of here. You know, what are you doing here? Can I get, you know, what's your name? He says, well, my name is Reb Yudel from such and such a place. I don't remember. Reb Yudel from Vilna. And he says, oh, Reb Yudel from Vilna. That's so strange. He says, what do you mean that's so strange? He says, well, the last few nights I've been having a dream about this treasure. And the dream is telling me that the treasure is under the stove, it's under the oven of Reb Yudel of Vilna's house. It says, really? The treasure is under my oven? So then he stops going to the bridge, and he goes all the way back home, and he goes all the way back into his kitchen, goes into the oven, and lo and behold, there's treasure right under the oven. That's the story. The question is what to learn from that story. So there are different versions of what the moral of the story is. One version of the story is, and this, I believe, is the Pshitzva version, and it's very much in line with the Pshitzva ideology. The Pshitzva moral of the story is you don't have to go to the Rebbe to find treasure. You can find it in your own kitchen, right? That's the point is you don't need a Rebbe. You do it yourself. That's very much a Pshitzva ideology, which is partly why I enjoy Pshitzva Chassidus. It's about, you know, doing the work yourself and understanding yourself. The other version of the story is sometimes to find your own treasure, you have to first go to the Rebbe. That's the other, the moral of the story. That's Rav Nachman's version of the story, right? Sometimes you have treasure. You don't know what you're capable of until you meet the Rebbe. And the Rebbe will help sort of guide you in the path. And then you can come home to your kitchen and you'll find the treasure right in your own home. But before you go to the Rebbe, you're not going to find it. That kind of thing. All right, so that's one of the famous stories. There are a lot of famous stories about Rav Nachman. There's king stories, poor people stories, the man of simple faith versus the man of sort of analytical faith. I believe the moral of the story there is to have a certain simplicity to your faith and don't overthink things. But there are a lot of stories, and you can look them all up online. But that's one sort of major tenet of Rav Nachman's teachings, the use of stories. And I talked about this, I don't know if it was last day, I think it was 2 Pesach ago, the power of a good story. It was this past Pesach. The power of stories and how they can motivate you, they can inspire you. When you put something in a story, it gives it a certain, thematic, arc that you can follow. You can relate to the characters and whatever. There's something about stories that's very, very influential. That's one idea. That's more of a methodological concept of Breslov. Another very important, perhaps the most important aspect of Breslov or Hasidic thought is the concept of a Yerida L'Tzorach Aliyah. A Yerida L'Tzorach Aliyah means that sometimes in order to grow, we have to fall down. And this is somewhat different than other Hasidic sects. At least in its sort of the process. The process is that when you're in a bad place, when you're in a dark place, you have to know that that's the beginning of redemption. Right? That's the geula is only coming out of gullus. Right? In order to be redeemed, you have to fall into exile first and foremost. And this is on a personal level, on a national level, a lot of ideas that come from that, and we'll see any idea from that soon. So, for instance, people might be familiar with, there was a song that became popular like 5-10 years ago, maybe. I don't know if people are in tune with Jewish music, but the song was Afil Bahastara. Anyone know that song? Afil Bahastara, Shevisoch Hastara, Bevadai Gamsham, Nimsa Hashem Yispara. I don't know if people are familiar with this song, but it's based on one of the teachings in Likutei Maharan, and it talks about how even in the most veiled of places, Hastara is the concealment of Hashem. The Hastara Shebetoch HaHastara, the concealed of the concealed, the darkest of darkest places. Even in those places, Hashem is there too. That's the idea. That's Breslov in a nutshell. That even as bad as you think things are, as terrible as you think you are, in your own Avodas Hashem, you should know that that's the beginning of your Geula, that's the beginning of your salvation, and you should never give up hope, because Hashem is with you in that darkest of places too. In connection to that, there's a fascinating line that I've talked about a few times now in Michigan, and that is the song, which is unbeknownst to many people, actually a line from Rav Nachman, not a line from Chazal, it's not a Gemara, it's not a Pasuk, or whatever. The line of Mitzvah Gedola Lios Besimcha Tamid. You know that one? Mitzvah Gedola Lios Besimcha Lios Besimcha Besimcha Tamid. I think it's Miami Boys. They made it very popular, they made it very catchy, whatever. And it means that there's a great mitzvah to be happy all the time. Now, in the shir that I give, it's very unclear what in the world he's talking about. There is no such mitzvah. It does not appear in the 613 mitzvot. It does not appear in the Mishnah Berurah. It doesn't appear in the Sefer HaMitzvot. It doesn't appear in the Gemara and the Medrash and the Chazal anywhere. There's no such mitzvah. And even the commentaries to Rav Nachman's books say, we don't know what this mitzvah is. In some way or another, what he's trying to impress upon the individual in that piece, if you look at that piece, is that when you're struggling with depression, it sounds a lot like he's talking about depression. I believe he uses the phrase marashchora, which is sort of like the blackened gallbladder. Is that what it is? They used to think that that depression came from like your, I think it was the gallbladder. You can look it up later. But that's what they used to call depression. And he says that if a person is in that state of debilitating sadness and depression, so then you won't be able to do any mitzvot. You'll just be sitting at home all day. And keep in mind that Reb Nachman's own personal experience was very much like this, the futility of the world, the nihilism that he was dealing with, and that Reb Nachman brought him out of. So the idea being that first and foremost, you have to be in a, not jovial is a weird word to use in this context, but you have to be happy about your lot in life. You have to be appreciative of your lot in life. Recognize the opportunities that you have. Be grateful for the things that you are given, as opposed to focusing on the bad things. So unclear what he means by mitzvah gedola, but presumably what he means is that it's of utmost importance to make sure that your attitude and your feelings are positive, so that you can do the mitzvahs properly afterwards. Unclear exactly what mitzvah he's referring to. When I give the shir about whether there's a mitzvah to be happy all the time, I end off the shir saying, yes, there is a mitzvah to be happy all the time, but it's not because of what Rav Nachman says, and I go through some of the nuances, but it's because there's a pasuk that says, v'yahavtas Hashem elokecha, that you should love Hashem, and the Sefer HaChinuch tells us that that's one of the six mitzvahs that apply at all times. We have a constant obligation to love Hashem at all times, every moment of the day. So there is a mitzvah to be happy all the time. It's just a specific thing to be happy about, and that is our connection to Hashem. That's another major concept of breast lover chassidus, to be happy, to be positive. Trying to think, is there any other that really stands out to me right now? I'm not sure. I can't think of anything right now. We did Hispodidus, we did the stories, we talked about, you read the Sarach Aliyah, we talked about Simcha. Those are really the four things that stand out to me right now. But I'm an outsider, right? If you talk to a breast lover, they might give you a whole other spiel about other things. But I wanted to finish off with one piece on the Parsha for this week, based on Likutei Halachos. I don't understand this, by the way. There's Likutei Halachos on Halacha, Shulchan Aruch, and then there's Likutei Halachos on the Parsha. I don't know how they're in the same Sefer, but either way. So this is after, I don't want to spoil the ending for anyone, but Yosef finally reveals himself to the brothers, and he says, it's me, Yosef, and his first question becomes, is dad still alive, as we know, Ha'od Avichai? And they say yes, they go back and forth, and they want to bring Yaakov down to Mitzrayim. But Yaakov doesn't want to go to Mitzrayim, right? Yaakov wants to stay in Eretz Yisrael. He obviously wants to go to Yosef, but he's worried. So Hashem says to Yaakov, don't worry. Anochi ered imach imcha Mitzrayim v'anochi alcha gam alo. Not only will I go down with you into Mitzrayim, but I will also bring the Jewish people back into Eretz Yisrael later. This is what Hashem says to Yaakov. You can already see where Rav Nachman's going to go with this. Again, this is Rav Nachman's idea, transcribed or written down by Rav Nachman. We'll move on b'tfarim. Shebizeh ha-pasuk merumas kol sod galus Yisrael. This pasuk that Hashem says to Yaakov, I'm going to bring you out of this. This is hinting to the entire secret of exile for the Jewish people. V'ha'ikar hi galus ha-nefesh. It's referring to the exiling, not just of our physical bodies, but of our spiritual bodies. Kol ha'aliyos v'ayiridos ha'ovrim al Yehudi, all of the elevations and the depressions or the goings down of a Jew. Shezeh ikar sod ha'galos v'agulah shehakol b'vchinas, anoch yered imcha mitzrayim avanoch alcha gamalo. Everything is within this pasuk. Hashem's going to bring us down, and he's going to bring us back up. Shezeu b'chinas yirida tachlis ha'aliyah, as I said before, k'muvah. V'ha'ikar hu, hischazkus. The main idea is to strengthen yourself. Anyone also know that song that people think is a Gemara, but is not? Kol ha'olam kulo, gesher tzar me'od, v'ha'ikar lo lefached klal. Right? That is a statement from Rav Nachman. The entire world is a very narrow bridge, but the main thing is to not be afraid, right? Same kind of idea. That you think it's difficult, you think it's bad, you think it's terrible, don't be afraid. Hashem's with you, you can do it, that kind of thing. You think that in those moments where it's so bitter, you're so low down, it looks like there's absolutely no hope at all. Specifically at that point where you're so low, you've hit rock bottom, Yirachim Allah Hashem Yisbarach V'Yoshio. That's where Hashem is going to save you. Only once you go all the way to the bottom, that's when Hashem is going to swoop in V'Yoshio and bring you salvation. V'Yikargu Elav Ki Lo Yitosh Hashem Amo. Hashem will never give up on His people. Uchmosh Hakas V'Yimartu Me'atar Agli Chas Hashem Yisadeni. Quote another thing, very interesting drashas there. V'Kasu V'Omer Avad Nitzchi V'Tochalti Me'Hashem Zos Ashiv Elivi Alkein Ochil Chas Hashem Ki Lo Samu Ki Lo Cholu Rachamav. Right, we paraphrase that in our Shemoneh Esrei. Chadashim Avgam Tzchulei. V'chein V'psukim Rabin. This is all over Tanakh. I can quote you many psukim like this. Shadaika kishe Yisrael heim betachas hadachkut v'hatzara chas v'shalom. Especially when they're feeling the pressure and the pain. You know, God forbid, az davka yesh tikfal yeshu gedolah. Specifically then, there is hope for the great salvation. V'chumash kasev b'midrash al-pasuk v'alam en ha'aretz daika. Hashem will take you. It's a beautiful read from the pasuk. This is not in this week's parsha. This is in Shmos. Va'alam in ha'aretz, and I will take you out of the land. You and I look at that pasuk and we say, oh, the Jews are in Egypt, and Hashem's going to take us out of Egypt. That's not what it means. Says Rav Nachman, va'alam in ha'aretz. I will bring you up from the land. What does it mean from the land? From the rock bottom. You've hit the rock bottom of the land. Hashem will bring us up only once you hit the land. Only once you hit rock bottom, that's when Hashem is going to bring you up. Allah min ha'aretz, when you fall to the ground, when you fall to the eretz, that's when Hashem is going to bring you up. V'chein impressive z'chol adam. And so it is with every individual person. U'v'chol's mind at every single time. Ki Hashem yitzbarach mahapech hamakal erfuah. He is going to switch the pain or the injury into the remedy. And that's all infused within the pasuk that Hashem says to Yaakov Avinu, I am going to go with you. I'll be with you as you go down. You're going down to Egypt. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be terrible. You're going to be slaves. That's when I'm going to take you out. Once you get that low, that's when I'll start bringing you back up. It's a fascinating concept, and it's something which is easier to say than to live, right? It's in, you know, when you're at the rock bottom, you don't really see that, but that's what Rav Nachman was doing. And there's something about this sort of life view, this life perspective of Rav Nachman that has hit a nerve, not a nerve in a negative sense. It's hit the core of a lot of people today. There's a lot of sort of psychology that revolves around, you know, it's difficult, but you can do it, right? It's difficult, things are bad, but you can pull yourself up. That kind of like, you know, rallying cry is very popular, and it's resonated with a lot of people today. And learning Likutei Maharan is on my bucket list. Don't tell any breast livers that. But, you know, I hear ideas from Rav Nachman, and I know Rav Moshe Weinberger is big on Rav Nachman, and some other colleagues of mine that are also into Rav Nachman. So it's on my bucket list to learn more of Rav Nachman. But it's this kind of sort of positive psychology of sort of the encouraging words of, I know it's difficult, but Hashem's with you and you can do it. That kind of thing is very resonant. For whatever reason, we can talk about, you know, sociological trends, you know, from today till tomorrow. But the point is that there's something about this life perspective that was, you know, 200 years before its time, that people are really, really, you know, really benefiting and gaining from this concept of the Yerida L'Tzarach Aliyah that Rav Nachman and Rav Nassim publicized and spread around through his teaching. So that's a glimpse into Rav Nachman. What you didn't hear from me today was all the breast liver stuff that you hear, you know, all the time. you know, this controversy and these people doing the nanach thing and the yarmulkes and the dancing and the peis flying all over the place. That's, to me, that's not the original Breslover. I don't want to insult anybody, but for me, what's most influential is Rav Nachman's words, and that's Rav Nachman Sternhardt, while he was technically the main student of Rav Nachman Breslov. He's really, and that's why I said it in the bulletin, he's the founder of Breslover Hasidus. If it wasn't for Rav Nachman, there would not be any Breslov Hasidus. It would just be, oh, there was this guy named Rav Nachman, he taught some few things, but we don't really know much about him. Right? Rav Nachman is the one that made it into a movement. He's the one that published all of the writings. It's only because of him that we have all of this Torah from Rav Nachman. And some of it is his own Torah too. So we have a lot to owe to him for publicizing and publishing all that material. Rav Nachman died at the age of 65, so also not a very old man, in 1845, on Yud Teves, also known as Asar B'Teves, on a fast day, which many people say was sort of there was a hashkacha there. And Rav Nachman, the person who was, always encouraging people that in darkest of times you should pull yourself up, died on a fast day. That recalls the difficulties of the Jewish people in the siege of Yerushalayim. So there's something about Rav Nachman's yard site on Asar B'Teves that people see as sort of like his life mission also. Anyways, that's a little bit of an insight, not just to Rav Nachman, but to Breslov Hasidus generally. Most likely because of this, I can't even talk about Rav Nachman anymore, because Rav Nachman is basically, took up the mantle of Rav Nachman. So anytime you hear about Breslovers and you hear about Rav Nachman, so you should know there was a man behind the scenes that was really making everything work. That was Rav Nachman Sternhardt, whose yard site is this coming week. And Mirat Hashem, whenever you hear of Rav Breslov, you'll know a little bit about them, a little bit about their main tenets, and if not just know about them, also be inspired by them and take into your own life some of the ideas that they have. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for joining in all Zoom crowd today. So I hope everyone's staying warm and staying safe. And the Mirat Hashem will continue with Mishlei a week from tonight. Everyone should be well.
Thank you.